Some years ago, a businessman, Herbert Gray, engaged in an 11-year quest to see if he could discover the common denominator of success. Eventually, he found it. He concluded that the major difference between successful people and failures was that successful people make a habit of doing what unsuccessful people don't like to do. And what are these things that failures don't like to do? It turned out that these were the same things that successful people didn't like to do either. But successful people discipline themselves to do them anyway. Getting up earlier, working harder, and staying later. Because successful people realized that these were the prices that one had to pay to rise above the average. As a wise man once said, there are always two choices, two paths to take. One is easy, and its only reward is that it's easy. Perhaps the most important word in success and achievement is sacrifice. Successful, happy people are willing to make the necessary sacrifices each day and throughout their lives to enjoy greater rewards and benefits at a later time. They are willing to pay the price of success over and over again until they attain it. Motivational speaker Dennis Waitley says that the difference between successes and failures is that unsuccessful people prefer activities that are tension-relieving, while successful people prefer activities that are goal-achieving. Successful people are willing to pay the price in terms of self-discipline, self-mastery, and self-control in advance in order to enjoy the rewards of success later on. This temptation to do what is fun and easy rather than what is hard and necessary is obvious everywhere. It is normal and natural and driven by the twin desires for comfort and leisure. Once a person has safety and security, he immediately turns to thoughts of comfort and leisure, sometimes to the exclusion of almost everything else. Most people prefer to chat with coworkers, go out for drinks after work, eat, watch television, socialize with friends, and generally engage in tension-relieving activities, rather than doing things that are more productive and helpful in terms of their future lives, families, and careers. According to several studies, the average American today, although paid for a 40-hour week, works only about 32 hours. According to Robert Half International, fully 50% of this time is wasted, spent in idle conversations with coworkers, personal business and phone calls, and extended coffee breaks and lunches. Of the approximately 16 hours that a person actually works, much of this is spent working inefficiently or on low-value activities. Fully 95% of your success will be determined by your habits. As Ed Foreman once said, good habits are hard to form but easy to live with. Bad habits are easy to form but hard to live with. Whatever you do repeatedly over and over soon becomes a new habit. If you get into the habit of chatting and socializing at work, very soon your interactions and conversations with your coworkers will begin to take up your whole day. Meanwhile, the things that you have been hired to accomplish, the key result areas of your job, will be neglected. Over time, you will be passed over for promotions and raises. Your career will slip into a backwater and other people will move ahead of you. Instead of accepting responsibility for yourself and your situation, you will begin to blame others, your boss, your colleagues, coworkers, and customers, for your situation. Occasionally, people who cannot discipline themselves to do their jobs properly not only get laid off or fired, but they sometimes become violent and shoot up their workplaces. The good news is that self-discipline is like a muscle. Every exercise of self-discipline in any area strengthens all your other disciplines. In Dorothea Brand's book, Wake Up and Live, she spends an entire chapter explaining how to develop your discipline muscles. From getting up in the morning and making your bed immediately, through to planning and preparing each day, being punctual, keeping your word, completing your assignments on time, and following through on your commitments to yourself and others. She explains how you can train yourself to become a highly disciplined person. Success is tons of discipline. The bad news is that every weakness in discipline in any area weakens all your other disciplines as well. They are not separable. The best part of the practice of self-discipline is that each time you discipline yourself to do something that you know you should do, your self-esteem goes up. You actually like yourself more. Your self-image improves. You respect yourselves more, and are more respected by others. Every act of self-discipline makes you a more confident, happier person. When you practice self-discipline regularly in small and large matters, you feel good about yourself. On the other hand, when you give in to the E factor, when you do the fastest and easiest thing and choose what is fun and easy over what is hard and necessary, your self-esteem goes down. You feel angry and frustrated. Your self-image gets worse, and your self-respect declines. You become a weak and irresolute person. In 1964, Dr. Edward Banfield published his book, The Unheavenly City, describing his 25 years of research into success in America and other countries. He updated it in 1989, concluding that nothing had changed in the ensuing quarter century. The focus of his inquiries was to seek out the real reason for upward socioeconomic mobility in American society. He asked, why is it that some people move up socially and economically in the course of their lifetimes, and others do not? He carefully compared factors such as family background, intelligence, schools or colleges attended, industry or businesses worked in, marriage and divorce, different cities or regions of the country, and personal talents and abilities. What he found was that these factors were necessary but not sufficient to explain success or failure. Each of these factors was helpful, but they were not enough. There did not seem to be any direct correlation between any of these factors and upward social mobility. Many people who started with every advantage failed to accomplish much, and many actually regressed socially and economically over the course of their lifetimes. Some people went to top universities and then went on to live mediocre lives. Others dropped out of high school and went on to head up major industries. Some people had high IQs and ended up going nowhere. Others with average IQs became extremely successful and respected people within their communities. Some successful people grew up with every blessing of family background, while others who became successful had immigrated to the U.S. knowing no one and not even speaking the language. After several years of research, Dr. Banfield finally stumbled on the real reason for socioeconomic advancement and upward mobility. He called it long-time perspective. He defined time perspective as the amount of time that a person takes into consideration when deciding what he is going to do in the present. He found that successful people tend to be future-oriented. They think about the future much of the time. They project 5, 10, and even 20 years into the future in considering their current decisions. Especially, they carefully calibrate what would be likely to happen in the future if they were to take a certain action in the present. As a result of thinking this way, they made better and better decisions in the short term that led to better and better results in the long term. Henry Hazlitt, in his book Economics in One Lesson, explained that the ability to accurately predict the secondary consequences of your actions is the true mark of the superior intellect. The initial reason for every action is expedient. It is focused on the primary consequences of the act, which are always positive, or the individual wouldn't act in the first place. The primary reason for every act is driven by the desire to get the things you want faster and easier than any other way available to you, with little concern for what is likely to happen as a result. But superior thinkers are more concerned about the long-term consequences of their actions. They play down the chessboard of life. They think several moves ahead. They analyze and evaluate what is likely to happen if they were to do or not do something. Only then do they decide to act. Both Hazlitt and Banfield came to the same conclusion. Long-term thinking dramatically improves short-term decision-making. The more you develop the habit of thinking long-term, the better decisions you make in the short term. The better decisions you make in the short term, the more likely it is that you will create the long-term future that you desire. It is the man or woman who thinks long-term, who does things in the present that can have positive results or benefits in the future, who is the one most likely to succeed and who is going to be the happiest and most fulfilled along the way. As I said earlier, one of the most important words in life and long-term success is sacrifice. It is the ability to delay gratification, to practice self-denial and self-restraint in the short term, which leads to greater success and rewards in the long term. There is a saying, short-term pain leads to long-term gain, but short-term gain often leads to long-term pain. In our society, we esteem long-term thinking and acting above almost any other quality. Surveys to determine the most respected Americans always come to the same conclusions. Doctors, judges, and professional people, people who have invested many years in study, preparation, and experience to get to where they are, always rank as the most respected people in our society. We recognize that they have made extraordinary investments of time, huge sacrifices over many years to reach their present positions. The opposite of long-term thinking is the habit of focusing on immediate gratification in the short term. This focus blinds people to the possible long-term consequences of their actions. Short-term thinking causes people to give in to the E factor and lies at the root of most of our personal, political, and social problems today. For example, a young man goes to school, fools around, is inattentive to his studies, gets poor grades, and finally drops out to get a job and buy a car. In the short term, he has a car and money, but at the price of a lifetime of low wages and limited possibilities. Another common example of short-term thinking is when labor unions strike for higher-than-market wages. Airlines, steel, automobile manufacturing, at the long-term price of making their companies and industries non-competitive with non-union or foreign suppliers. They get increased wages in the short term at the price of permanently crippling their companies and industries in the long term, throwing them out of work permanently. For example, the higher union wage premium in the railroad industry accounted for 64% of the decline in union jobs over the past 24 years. From 1973 to 1987 alone, employment on railroads dropped from 520,000 people to 249,000. These jobs are gone forever. Short-term gain led to long-term pain. Another example of short-term thinking that is damaging our country is when the government continually increases expenditures, expands programs, adds entitlements, boosts budget, hires more people at inflated salaries at the long-term cost of huge government deficits that will have to be repaid by our children and grandchildren. Many people quit their jobs in the short term to live off unemployment at the long-term price of diminished self-respect and lower lifetime earnings. Criminals engage in robberies, burglaries, and theft to get immediate money at the price of long prison sentences and ruined lives in society. People in the workplace only do what they have to do to earn a paycheck and then spend their time socializing and watching television at the long-term price of underachievement and failure in life. Overall, men and women continually do what is fun and easy in the short term rather than what is hard and necessary at the long-term price of never fulfilling their unique potentials as human beings. Aristotle once wrote, "All advancement in civilization begins with the development of character in the young." The greatest need for a child is to learn the core values of self-discipline, honesty, integrity, responsibility, courage, compassion, hard work, generosity, and persistence. The child learns these virtues by being instructed by his parents in them and by seeing his parents demonstrate them in their daily lives. Once a child has been taught these values and virtues, he must then be encouraged to develop the self-control and personal mastery necessary to live by them, no matter what the temptation of the moment. The most important quality for a child to learn is self-discipline, the ability to delay gratification. This quality will have an impact on the child for the rest of his life. In an experiment at Harvard some years ago, they tested this idea. They seated several children under the age of 5 around a table and gave each of them a candy. They told these children that if they could refrain from eating this candy, they would receive 2 candies when the experimenter came back into the room. They then watched the children through a one-way mirror. Some of the children gobbled up the candy immediately. Others did not. As the time passed, the children who were holding themselves back from eating the candy engaged in all kinds of behaviors to control themselves. Some closed their eyes. Some covered up the candy. Some looked away from the candy. Others sang or spoke to themselves. most of them finally gave in and ate the candy. 20 years later, they followed up on these children. What they found was quite revealing. There turned out to be a direct relationship between how quickly the child ate the candy after the researcher had left the room and how successful and happy he had turned out to be in adult life. The ones who had gobbled the candy immediately were generally dissatisfied, struggling, and working at lower-level jobs. The ones who held themselves back from eating the candy were more successful, happier, and better paid. This is why the success author Napoleon Hill once wrote, "Self-discipline is the master key to riches." The greatest need we have today in every area is for men and women to practice the values of integrity, discipline, responsibility, courage, and long-time perspective, both as individuals in the workplace and with their families. These are the key qualities of leadership. Our society needs leaders at all levels who practice the principles that lead to long-term success. Especially, we need people in positions of authority and political power to support and encourage others, whose lives and work they influence to develop character and resist the tendency to act expediently in ways that are harmful to themselves and other people. Everyone needs to take the values pledge, to live by it, and then to encourage others to live by it as well. It is only the solid bulwark of character based on values, virtues, long-term thinking, and the accurate assessment of secondary consequences that can curb and mitigate the destructive influences and behavior of the E factor. The philosopher Immanuel Kant postulated what he called the universal maxim. He suggested that you should live your life as though your every act were to become universal law for all other people. I wrote earlier that the very best judge of truth for you is to ask, is this true for me? If everyone was encouraged to live as though their every act were to become a universal principle for all others, most government policies and programs would be abolished overnight. The fact is that the only way that many something-for-nothing programs and policies in government and society can be put forward is with the hope that most people will not take advantage of them. Think about it. What if everyone were to go on welfare? What if everyone were to go on unemployment insurance? What if everyone were to apply for every government program that was available to them? What if everyone dedicated themselves to doing the very least amount of work that they could get away with? What if everyone began spending all their time trying to get free money from anywhere that it might be available? The answer is that our society would collapse overnight. Here are 4 questions that you can ask and answer every day to keep yourself on track in each part of your life. First, ask yourself, what kind of a world would this world be if everyone in it was just like me? When you ask and answer this question honestly, you'll admit that if everyone in the world was just like you, this would probably not be the best of all possible worlds. Look into yourself and think about some of the things that you could change or do differently to become a better citizen of the world. The second question you can ask is, what kind of a country would America be if everyone in it was just like me? This is perhaps the most important question that we can ask and answer of ourselves. If everyone in America did the same things that you did every single day, would America be a better, happier, healthier, and more prosperous democracy? If not, what are some of the changes that you could make in your behaviors that would make America a better place? The third question you can ask is, what kind of a company would my company be if everyone in it was just like me? If you are honest with yourself, you will see different things that you could do to become a more valuable and important contributor to your company. Perhaps you could start a little earlier, work a little harder, or stay a little later. Perhaps you could volunteer for more assignments or upgrade your knowledge and skills as they relate to your job. How could you become the very best person you could possibly become at your work? The final question, and perhaps the most important, is, what kind of a family would my family be if everyone in it was just like me? If everyone in your family behaved the way you do and treated everyone else the way you treat them, would your family be a warmer, happier, and more loving group of people? What could you do starting today to be a better family member? The true mark of the superior person is that he sets high standards for himself and refuses to compromise those standards for any reason. He sees himself as a role model for others. He behaves at all times as if everyone was watching, even when no one is watching. The truly superior person does not give in to the forces of expediency. He does not seek something for nothing. He refuses to take anything to which he is not entitled. He insists upon earning everything he gets. He practices the golden rule and treats everyone the way he would like to be treated himself. He sets high standards for himself and continually strives to meet those standards. If everyone in America were to take the pledge below, this would be a better country in every way. Here is the values pledge. I hereby resolve to clarify and to live by the values of integrity, honesty, truth, and courage, to remain true to the highest standards I know, and to be the best person I can possibly be. I will not compromise what I know to be right for any reason. I will live my life as though my every act was to become a universal law for everyone else. And then you sign that and resolve to live by it. Let us look now at the current dilemma we find ourselves in today, the problems and difficulties that the out-of-control force of the E-factor, multiplied times the desire to get something for nothing, have gotten us into, and how we can get out of them. Remember the quote from Abraham Lincoln, where he says, "It is the eternal struggle between these two principles, right and wrong. They are the two principles that have stood face to face from the beginning of time and will ever continue to struggle. It is the same spirit that says, you work and toil and earn bread, and I'll eat it." Chapter 5, The Current Dilemma. In Lewis Carroll's book, Alice in Wonderland, Alice is arguing with the Mad Hatter over a ridiculous idea that he has suggested. Alice says, "You can't believe something like that. It's impossible." The Mad Hatter replies with some pride, "Nonsense. I've developed the ability to believe at least two completely impossible things every morning before breakfast." Likewise, the United States today and much of the world is filled with people who proclaim and declare completely impossible things, usually out of a combination of both ignorance and expediency. Clamoring voices, detached from reason and oblivious to both human and personal experiences, have resorted to what is called argumentation by assertion. They feel that if they can say or write an impossible thing often enough in enough different ways, it will somehow begin to come true, like a fairy tale. In propaganda, as developed to an art by the Nazis in the 1930s, this is known as the big lie method of influencing public opinion. This theory says that if you repeat a big lie often enough, eventually people will come to believe it, even if it contains no truth at all. Once people start to believe something, even if it's completely false, they develop a form of selective perception. They begin to seek for and find more and more evidence to support their new belief. Once a person has started to believe something, he selectively ignores and excludes any and all information or evidence that contradicts the new chosen belief. He becomes more and more convinced of the accuracy and rightness of the idea. Finally, he becomes impervious to any evidence to the contrary and even attacks those who disagree. It's important to remember that no one is born with any religious, political, social, or personal beliefs. All beliefs are learned as the result of instruction, experience, and repetition. What is worse is that many beliefs that people hold dearly are false. They are not only not backed up by fact, but flatly contradicted by all available evidence. Assertion is not proof. Only facts are proof. Abraham Lincoln was once arguing a point with his cabinet minister, William Stanton. He stopped the conversation and asked, "If you call a dog's tail a leg, how many legs would the dog now have?" Stanton quickly replied, 5. "No," replied Lincoln, "calling a dog's tail a leg doesn't make it a leg. Here's the point. Believing something, wanting something to be true, has no bearing whatever on whether it's true or not. Repeating a false claim or fact does not make it true." Napoleon Hill, who studied the most successful and richest men in America for 25 years, concluded that the best advice he could give others was, never try to violate natural laws and win. The iron law of the universe, the foundation principle of Western civilization, was first propounded by Aristotle in about 350 BC at his academy outside of Athens. This law was subsequently known for 2,000 years as the Aristotelian principle of causality. He said simply that we live in an orderly universe governed by law. Therefore, everything that occurs happens for a reason, whether or not we know what that reason is. Up to that time, most people believed that the world was controlled by the gods on Mount Olympus or by random chance. After Aristotle propounded his dictum, people began to realize that there is an explanation for every event. Today we call this the law of cause and effect. It says that for every effect, there is a specific cause or series of causes. Nothing happens by accident. If you want to get or duplicate a particular effect, you must first identify and then duplicate the cause of that effect. This is the foundation principle of all of modern science and technology. When someone refers to a scientific formula, he is saying that this formula has a proven cause and effect relationship. As a result, it has a high degree of replicability. Something is scientifically validated only if it can be replicated by someone else implementing the same cause-effect relationships as the original scientist. Throughout history, man has never invented any law or principle in any area, science, mathematics, physics, economics, or medicine. He has only discovered them. All laws, such as gravity, have always existed. All principles, such as those used in mathematics, have been true for all time. Some things are always true. They never change. This is especially true with regard to human nature, the expediency factor, the desire to get something for nothing, the lust for money and power, and the principles of economics that predict and explain wealth and affluence, or poverty and deprivation. Here is the basic law. Nothing comes from nothing. In our material world, something must be produced before it can be consumed. Everything comes from something. This means that if someone consumes without producing, then someone else must produce without consuming. All wealth is created or produced by one or more people. There is no causeless or unearned wealth or production. To give any economic good or money to anyone, you must first take it away from someone else. In the New Testament, we first learn of the law of sowing and reaping. It says, "Whatsoever a man soweth, that also shall he reap." This law says that you cannot reap without sowing first. It also says that you cannot sow one thing and reap another. You cannot sow wheat and reap barley. You cannot sow apples and get pears. Whatever you put in, you get out. This is a universal, immutable law. Now notice the order of this law. It says that first you sow and then you reap. It is not vice versa, as many would like to believe. Sir Isaac Newton, one of the most important figures in scientific history, explained the law of action and reaction. He says that for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, whatever you do, you cause something to happen in equal measure. What you put in, you get out. You cannot do something without triggering a consequence of some kind. For all of human history, no one argued against these laws. They were accepted as facts of life. Each person saw that his role in life was to somehow organize his activities in harmony with these laws in order to survive and thrive. For much of human history, people knew that you had to first produce something before you could consume it. The development of civilization has involved people coming together in villages and towns, then cities and nations, to work cooperatively in order to be more productive. Individuals joined communities from the very beginning because, being expedient, they felt that the fastest and easiest way to get the things they wanted was to work together with others to produce more for everyone. Most of the wars of history have been aimed at loot and plunder, taking lands that others had cleared and cultivated and assets that others had manufactured and created. The governments of countries, kingdoms, nations, and empires developed to protect the populace from the predatory actions of aggressors who might try to invade and rob the citizens of the goods and crops they had produced. For hundreds of years, progress was slow and halting. After the growth and expansion of the Roman Empire, civilization and prosperity declined into a dark age of poverty, famine, pestilence, and war that lasted for 1,000 years. Finally, in Italy and throughout Europe, the Renaissance began. Trade expanded, inventions poured onto the market, the printing press was invented, and a new age began. Instead of looting and plundering and ceaseless wars, people organized into cities, provinces, and states, formed guilds, developed skills, initiated trade, discovered the Americas, and began creating and producing products and wealth at a rate never seen before. On the crest of this revolution of thought and incredible advancements in science and technology, the American nation was born, rooted in the fundamental principles of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights were designed to create a legal structure to assure that the United States would be a nation where anyone could come and build a life free from oppression and expropriation. The concept of making money, of creating wealth and keeping ownership of it, was revolutionary. For more than 200 years, up to the current day, people have flocked from all over the world by the millions to participate in this American dream. Because of the E factor, programmed deep into human nature, America, like all countries, has its crime and corruption. But fortunately, America is the first country to be governed from the outset by law rather than by the arbitrary whims of people in power. The Founding Fathers realized that the greatest danger to individual freedom was the government, and the tendency of people in power to use government action and coercion to get the things they wanted the fastest and easiest way possible. To guard against this, the Founding Fathers set up a system of checks and balances to protect individual citizens against the government. They were determined to put in place a constitution that would assure that government of the people, by the people, and for the people would prevail for the indefinite future. For 200 years and up to the current day, it was generally understood that you achieved financial success by producing goods and services of value, earning a good living thereby, and saving out of your income to provide for your future needs in your retirement. The foundation principles of the American Republic are freedom, liberty, honesty, individualism, self-reliance, responsibility, courage, determination, and competition, all practiced within the framework of peaceful cooperation. The role of government in this system is to keep the peace, to protect citizens from external aggression with an army and navy, and from internal threats to life and property with the police and the courts. In the economic sphere, to assure maximum entrepreneurial activity, growth, and prosperity, the role of government is to protect private property, enforce contracts, and maintain a stable currency. As long as the government restricted itself to these few activities, America flourished and became the economic powerhouse of the world. In the 20th century, in America and throughout the more advanced industrialized countries, incredible achievements in wealth creation produced a cornucopia of products and services that had never before been imaginable, and is still not imaginable in most of the world. More wealth was created in a shorter time than ever before in history. Between 1815 and 1914, the living standard of the average person in America or England rose 100 times. With this extraordinary growth in living standards and expansion of wealth and the wealthy, the E factor began to rear its ugly head. For the first time, people began to believe that it was possible to get something for nothing. Well-meaning people, dreamers and utopians with no understanding of entrepreneurship, risk, investment, productivity, capital flows, or competition, began to think in terms of sharing this newly created wealth. Not understanding that everything has to be produced by the labor of someone, well-meaning people began promoting the ideas that the government should use its powers to expropriate the wealth and property of the successful in order to share it with people they considered to be less fortunate and more deserving. From then to now, the guiding principle of redistribution has been to violate the natural laws of cause and effect, sowing and reaping, and action and reaction. The idea of something for nothing, appealing to a few people at first, and then more and more fed off the twin emotions of envy and resentment. The dam began to break as the 20th century progressed. The ideas for redistribution increased and multiplied without control or limit. Politicians eager for votes began offering free money in exchange for those votes, and many got elected. They promised to use the power of the law, the power of taxation, backed by the threat of fines, arrest, and imprisonment, to expropriate money and property from those who had produced it to give to those who had not produced it at all. If what government began doing to the individual taxpayer was done by one private party to another, it would be called theft. When done behind the veil of the law, it is called policy or compassion. However it is defined, taking money away from those who have earned it to give it to those who have not earned it is a form of stealing. Once the voters began to realize that they could get free money by voting for the right person, the E-factor was unleashed like a flood. Every government free money scheme benefits one specific subset of voters, while it penalizes another specific, usually smaller, subset of voters. For example, laws restricting apartment rentals are always aimed at apartment owners with the aim of benefiting apartment renters. There are always vastly more tenants than landowners. The E-factor reigns supreme. As we know now, the idea of free money makes people crazy. It drives them insane. It quickly becomes an obsession. Free money releases passions and triggers behaviors that can lead to demonstrations and riots. Urged on by demagogues, aided by the stench of envy, mixed with resentment, multiplied by greed for the property of others, the justifications for national theft filled the air. The successful were called robber barons and disparaged on every street corner. The something-for-nothing people ignored the fact that it was the entrepreneurial energy, risk-taking courage, and inventiveness of people like Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, John D. Rockefeller, and Harvey Firestone, all of whom started with nothing, that created thousands of jobs while they reinvested almost everything they earned. As the 20th century progressed, the something-for-nothing fever raged like an epidemic, flowing into the roaring 20s and driving stock market prices through the roof. People began to believe that there was no limit to the amount of free money they could get from government policies and programs, or unearned money from soaring stock prices. But the party had to end, and so it did, on October 26, 1929, with the Great Crash. Over the next 2 years, the stock market continued downward. The unemployment rate rose to 24%. The New Deal of Franklin D. Roosevelt failed completely. Instead of allowing the free market to exert its natural corrective influence on the economy, both Herbert Hoover and Franklin D. Roosevelt imposed sweeping regulations on wages and prices, combined with the Smoot-Hawley tariffs that crippled world trade and drove many other countries into depression as well. Even though Franklin D. Roosevelt was hailed as a hero for his efforts, everything he did made the situation worse. Year after year, the unemployment rate was stuck above 20%. By 1938, almost 9 years after the start of the Depression, the unemployment rate was up to 28% in parts of the U.S. People began predicting that the Depression would go on for decades and might never end. World War II ended the Depression by absorbing hundreds of thousands of men and women into the factories and the armed forces. During World War II, as in all wars, the government grew and expanded, eventually controlling more than 40% of the U.S. economy. After the war, as normally happens, it never really went back to its former size. In the 1950s, the greatest age of American prosperity began. America was the only country that had been unscathed by the war. Its industrial plant was intact. It had the capacity to produce more goods and services than all the rest of the world put together. The demand for American products was seemingly insatiable. The primary reason for prosperity in the United States then and now was, and is, the innovativeness, productivity, and managerial excellence of American individuals and corporations in comparison to and in competition with the rest of the world. However, in the 1960s, the baby boomer generation began pouring out of the schools and universities and into the workforce. They had no memory of the Depression or World War II, and no understanding of the sources of wealth and prosperity, hard work, and productive corporations. All they saw around them was prosperity. Professors like John Kenneth Galbraith, in his book, The Affluent Society, declared that America had reached the point where wealth creation was inevitable and unstoppable. The only questions were, how do we control it, spend it, redistribute it, and give it away to those who need it? In 1965, President Lyndon Johnson initiated his Great Society legislation, and the E-Factor was unleashed. The desire to get something for nothing exploded. Every conceivable program for the War on Poverty was launched, eventually costing more than $5 trillion without reducing poverty at all. Today, the percentage of people officially living in poverty is very much the same as it was in the 1960s. Year after year, in every statehouse and department in Washington, idea after idea, program after program to distribute free money to poor people, farmers, corporations, the old, the young, the sick, the well, and everyone in between was embraced. Politics became a means for using government power to tax, regulate, expropriate, and channel free money in all directions, but especially to targeted voters. The new mantra of the politicians, repeated over and over on Capitol Hill and throughout Washington, was tax, 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 spend, 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 elect, elect, elect. Every election became an auction where the candidates competed to outdo each other in offering even more free money to their voter base. Government grew and grew. Taxes were increased and increased some more. The politicians spent even more than they could tax and covered the gap with borrowings and printed money. This led to inflation, huge deficits, and multi-trillion-dollar national debts that will never be repaid. The idea of free money causes people to lose all sense of reality. They begin to believe impossible things, especially that there is no link between producing and consuming. They begin to believe that there is a bottomless bucket of free money controlled by politicians that they are entitled to. The free money sickness soon became an obsession. People began to think of nothing else. But free money, something for nothing, destroys the soul of the person who gets it or who even tries to get it. It causes him to engage in crooked thinking and impossible rationalizations to explain why he is entitled to this free money. Almost always the desire to get or give free money is disguised by high-sounding talk about the poor, the sick, the aged, or the young, all guaranteed to tug at the heartstrings of normal people. In every case, however, people either want free money for themselves directly, or they want to be in charge of giving free money to others as a source of employment or gratitude or both. Here's the problem. As Aristotle explained in his Nicomachean Ethics, the ultimate aim of all action is to achieve the happiness of the actor, as I said before. The core psychological requirements for happiness is a feeling of personal value and self-esteem, a condition in which you genuinely like and respect yourself. But true and lasting self-esteem and happiness is only possible when you feel that you are making a contribution to your world that is greater than the amount you are receiving back. When you feel that what you are doing is important and valuable, and that you are doing more than you're getting paid for, you feel good about yourself. However, if your aim is to take money away from those who produce it, to give to yourself or others, you are engaging in a form of theft that actually diminishes the well-being of everyone who is affected by it. People who receive free money or benefits that they have not earned feel angry, diminished, dishonest, and of lower value. Their feelings of insecurity increase, and their self-esteem plummets. Most people at the receiving end of government free money programs are neither thankful nor grateful. Instead, they are more likely to be sullen and demanding. The fastest way to trigger an angry demonstration or a series of vituperative television ads is to threaten to reduce or even modify the free money or privileges going to a favored group. Free money is like an addictive drug. From the first taste, like crack cocaine, the recipient of free money is hooked. Once he has taken it for a while, he must have even more to get the same temporary satisfaction. And no amount is ever enough. The addiction to free money, whether as a welfare recipient, criminal, or person who lives off the sweat of others, leads to feelings of resentment, hostility, insecurity, and ever-escalating demands for more free money. Today, our entire society is infected with this something-for-nothing virus, corrupting all our social and political systems. In every government office, people are lined up to ask for, demand, plead for, beg for, and protest for more free money. The only obstacle to the complete collapse of our society into a political war of all against all for more free money is the bulwark of law that underpins our society and the character of men and women who refuse to succumb to the siren song of something for nothing. There are two major motivators of behavior that modify and affect the basic instincts and desires we discussed in chapters 1 and 2. The first is the desire for gain. This is extremely intense and a major motivator, whether it is for safety, security, leisure, comfort, love, respect, or fulfillment, and especially if its focus is power and money. The second major motivator of behavior is the fear of loss, of having something taken away. According to psychologists, the fear of loss is at least 2.5 times more powerful than the desire for gain. What this means is that people are strongly motivated to get what they want the fastest and easiest way possible, and preferably free. But if you threaten to take something they already have away from them, their motivation to protect and defend what they have is at least 2.5 times more powerful. Threatening to reduce or cut off a person's free money or benefits from the government or from any other source triggers far more resistance and even violent behavior than they demonstrated to get the free money in the first place. This intense resistance to the threatened withdrawal of free money or benefits explains why people pour into the streets to demonstrate and protest at any proposed reduction in government programs. The only cure for the disease of the E-factor, aimed at getting something for nothing, is to not make it available in the first place. Whenever something for nothing has taken root, triggering personal and emotional devastation, it must be cut back as quickly as possible, lest the recipients be destroyed morally, ethically, and emotionally. Remember, there's never an end to the justifications for legal theft via taxation to reward and benefit those who have not earned it. But whenever you violate the natural laws of cause and effect, sowing and reaping, action and reaction, you set in motion a series of events with long-term consequences that are often vastly worse than if you had done nothing at all. The contest is always between the two approaches, short-term pain for long-term gain versus long-term gain for short-term pain. Just as the cruelest things parents can do is to spoil their children, thereby setting them up for a lifetime of frustration and disappointment, the cruelest thing we can do for the less fortunate among us is to get them addicted to free money, thereby destroying all their hopes for the future. We must not allow this to happen, and where it has already occurred, we must make every effort to stop it. In medicine, they say, accurate diagnosis is half the cure. In these first 5 chapters, you have developed a complete and clear diagnosis or understanding of why people do what they do. You now know what everyone wants, how the structure of incentives determines the actions that people take, and the importance of character. You now understand the evolution and origins of the dilemma we face, both individually and as a people, and how we got here. Let us now look at what is happening in government as the result of the something-for-nothing principle gone berserk. Chapter 6. Government, Politics, and Power. As Alexis de Tocqueville once wrote, "The American Republic will endure until the politicians realize that they can bribe the people with their own money." The United States is the greatest country in the world. America is a great country not only because of its political system, but mainly because of its people. America is good because Americans are good. Americans are the most generous people on earth, giving more money to charity nationally and internationally each year than any other country, and probably more than all the other countries in the world put together. America is the most welcoming country in the world. America accepts more new immigrants each year than all the countries of the world put together. America has the strongest economy in the world. With only 6% of the world's population and 6% of the world's landmass, the United States produces 30% of the total gross world product out of a total of 194 countries. The Los Angeles area alone, if it were a separate country, would be the seventh largest country in the world economically. Militarily, America is the most powerful country in the world. Its Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard are the best equipped and trained and are made up of some of the finest and most competent fighting men and women on Earth. They are a force in every corner of the globe. But all of these are secondary reasons for why America is such a great country. America is a great country because it provides more opportunities and possibilities for the average person than any other country on Earth, or than in history. There are four common goals of all people in all lands at all times. They are, first of all, to be healthy and to live a long life. Second, people want to be in stable families and enjoy happy relationships with others. Third, everyone wants to do meaningful work that makes a difference and be well paid for it. And fourth, everyone wants to acquire enough money to be financially independent at some time in his or her life. We know by now that because of the expediency factor, everyone is lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient. We know that everyone is motivated to get as much as they can of safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment. We also know that the fastest and easiest way for a person to get all the things he wants is to acquire money or power or both. The truth is that in America, it is more possible for more people to get more of all the things they want, including the big four above, than any other country on Earth. As a result, people from every country on Earth flock to the United States to participate in the possibilities of America. No other country can say that. The American Green Card, allowing a person to live and work legally in the United States, is the most valuable and valued piece of paper on Earth. The United States of America is no accident. It was carefully designed in a constitutional convention containing some of the finest minds that have ever come together in a single place in the history of man on Earth. The Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights combine the best thinking of these remarkable men to create an exercise in self-government and democracy that had never been seen before. They combine the finest ideas that man had ever thought and written about, from the first democracy of ancient Greece all the way through to the great thinkers of the Enlightenment, and created the American system of government, the longest enduring constitutional government in the world. From the very beginning, the U.S. was designed for the common man, for the person starting with little or nothing, for the immigrant who came to America with little more than a hope and a dream. No other country on Earth can make this claim. All the other countries were designed by and for the rich and powerful. Our legal and commercial system was designed to encourage and reward self-reliance, entrepreneurship, and personal responsibility. It was based on the assumption that free men living and working together within a framework of law and order that protected their rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness could and would create good lives for themselves and their neighbors. In the Federalist Papers, James Madison wrote and warned about the dangers of factions. These were defined as individuals and groups who, driven by the E factor, by the normal human tendencies toward laziness, greed, ambition, selfishness, ignorance, vanity, and impatience, aimed at the never-ending desire to achieve more safety, security, comfort, leisure, love, respect, and fulfillment, expressed in the desire for money and power as the fastest way to achieve them, might try to take advantage of others in society. The chief concern of the Founding Fathers was to protect the individual citizen from the power of the government. Their intention was that the federal government should be small and limited. The state governments, closest to the people, should handle all but the functions that were only possible for the national government. They wanted to keep government small at all levels because they knew that the power to tax and regulate is the power to harass and destroy. They had already experienced the abuses possible by government in the form of unjust and unreasonable laws imposed on the colonies by the British government of King George III. The key to maintaining the maximum of liberty and opportunity for Americans, which they only arrived at after many days and weeks of debate, was a system of checks and balances. The main purpose of these checks and balances was to block the government from infringing on the basic liberties fought for and won in the Revolutionary War. Because the individual states were jealous and protective of their rights, the power of the central government was strictly limited to protecting national security and providing services in areas that individual states could not provide for themselves, such as armies and navies for national defense. The primary role of government was designed to be the protection of the nation from external aggression and the protection of individual citizens from internal oppression, aggression, or crime. All powers not specifically granted to the government by the people were to remain in the hands of the people. Power was handed up by the people to the government rather than being handed down. In the legal systems of England and the countries of Europe, power flowed downward from the king through the representatives to the people. In the United States, however, the power was vested in the individual citizens and was meant to flow from the people to their representatives and upward to the state houses, the Congress, and the Senate. Power would flow from the individual states to the federal government. All powers not explicitly granted to the federal government in the Constitution were to be the exclusive property of the states and only exercised by them. Elected officials were to be selected by their neighbors to represent their interests in the state house or in Washington. Running for and serving in office was looked upon as a civic duty, a contribution that one made to his country during the course of his career. Legislators were citizens with careers and businesses at home, to which they would return after having served their time in office. The Founding Fathers did not envision career politicians who attempted to stay in office for the rest of their lives. It was well known and generally understood at the founding that government had no money of its own. Government produces nothing. It only consumes. Every dollar that government gives out, it must first take away from someone in the form of taxes. For every service that government performs, it must first tax the money away from someone. It then charges a minimum of 50% for administration before turning the money around and sending it back out to its chosen constituencies. For every job that government creates, it must destroy at least one job in the private sector. It must eliminate a job that someone is doing to provide a product or service that someone wants in order to create a government job doing something that few people want or at least that no one is willing to pay for. Whenever government builds a public building, you can be sure that there is a private building or more than one that will not be built. Frederick Bastiat, the French economist, once wrote a booklet, What is Seen and What is Not Seen? In this classic treatise, he points out that what government does with tax money is seen by the population, but what is not seen is the devastation that is caused by the money being taken away from the people who have earned it, the jobs and businesses that are destroyed, and the hopes and dreams that are shattered. The power to tax and regulate were hotly debated and jealously guarded at the founding and during the Constitutional Convention of 1787. The idea of an income tax was fought and resisted by members of both parties because of their fear that once it was in place, it would be misused and manipulated and continually increased. In fact, when the first income tax was passed by a constitutional amendment in 1915, it only called for a 1% tax on people earning $5,000 or more, which would be about $100,000 in 2005 dollars. By 1920, tax rates, however, had risen to 70% on some people, and virtually everyone in America was subject to income tax. As soon as the something-for-nothing dam broke, the spread of taxation became a flood. Nonetheless, because of exemptions and deductions, in 1940 the federal government was only taxing away 11% of national income. Today, governments at all levels consume 42% of the national income, starting with income taxes on individuals and corporations, and then extending to hundreds, if not thousands, of taxes and hidden charges at every level of society and on every imaginable product and activity. In 2004, the average person had to work until May 25th just to pay his taxes. Driven by envy and resentment, and the need to get votes to create new taxes and raise existing taxes, opportunistic politicians always promise only to tax the rich. Violating the basic American value of equality, which includes the tax laws, progressive taxation was introduced and then made more progressive each year. In 2004, according to the IRS, the wealthiest 1% of taxpayers paid 33.89% of all federal income taxes. The wealthiest 5% pay 53.25% of income taxes paid. The top 10% pay 64.89%, the top 25% pay 82.9%, and the top 50% of earners in the U.S. pay 96.3% of all federal income taxes. The bottom 50% of income earners in America pay less than 4% of the taxes and consume most of the services in the hundreds of billions of dollars provided by government. And the only solution the politicians have is to tax the rich even more. The rich, those people earning a living, are already paying 96% of all the taxes collected in America. And this doesn't even include state taxes. Perhaps the height of dishonesty is when politicians say that reductions in tax rates only benefit the rich. Simple logic says that if you are making a high income, any general tax reduction will be more beneficial to you than to someone who pays no taxes at all. Reducing taxes only benefit people who are paying taxes in the first place. Today in America, there are more and more people who pay little or no taxes at all who are voting for politicians who promise to give them more and more free money to be paid out of taxes to be raised on those people who are already paying 96% of the taxes. The purpose of government in general has become to tax and spend. Almost every piece of legislation and activity of government is aimed at taking money from some members of society and giving it to others. The goal of taxers and spenders is to extract as much money as possible without killing the goose that lays the golden egg. Sometimes they're successful, sometimes not. In the early 1990s, the Democrat-dominated Congress passed a law that vastly increased the taxes on new yachts. Their contention was that only the rich purchased yachts and that the rich would continue paying this tax because, after all, they had so much money. What the Congress did not realize is that the entire yacht-building industry on the eastern seaboard consisted of tens of thousands of specialized carpenters, tinkerers, sailmakers, hull builders, electricians, plumbers, craftsmen, artisans, and others who worked together in teams to build these boats. When the Congress increased the taxes on new yachts, but not on old yachts or imported yachts, yacht buyers throughout America simply stopped buying new boats. Instead, they kept or refurbished their existing boats or bought yachts from other countries. Most of the yacht-building industry went bankrupt. More than 90,000 skilled craftsmen, most with no other skills or way to earn a living, were thrown out of work. The outcry was so loud that the legislation was repealed, but not until after having wreaked enormous damage to countless small towns and villages where yacht-building took place, and to the families of the blue-collar workers who were bankrupted in the interim. The law of unintended consequences had struck again. Now let's look at the process of acquiring and using political power. When a person begins to think of running for office, his personality, his values, and his convictions often change, sometimes dramatically. No matter what his ideas and principles, clear or unclear, before declaring for office, as soon as potential voters begin questioning him, he begins backing and shuffling, double-talking and speaking out of both sides of his mouth. You see, politicians are essentially entrepreneurial in nature. They are going into the market to sell a product, themselves. The payment they are seeking is the votes of the electorate. The electorate chooses their representatives based on the relative attractiveness of the package that the candidate offers. Every single principle of marketing and sales, determined by pollsters, consultants, and advisors, is brought to bear to win the political prize. After all, enormous amounts of money can be at stake. James Buchanan, Jr., 1986 winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, received his award for his work in what is called public choice theory. In his exhaustive research, he demonstrated that political expediency, or the desire for lazy, greedy, ambitious, selfish, vain, ignorant, and impatient people to get elected to office so that they can get the power, perks, and money that office provides, would determine what positions these people would take to get elected. Buchanan proved that opinion polls on various issues taken in the politician's district were a better and more accurate predictor of the politician's platform and programs than any other economic, social, or philosophic principle. In other words, most politicians running for office say what they need to say to attract the greatest number of potential voters to help them get elected the fastest and easiest way possible. Because politicians are human, we should not expect them to behave otherwise. Neither should we be surprised when they act like typical politicians. That's what they are. Something happens to a person when the smell of power gets into his nostrils. His personality changes. The idea of winning distorts his valuations. The thought of being elected is exciting and stimulating. He soon comes to believe that winning is not just the only thing. Winning is everything. Joseph Lieberman has been in the Senate for many years and is one of the most thoughtful and respected politicians in Washington on both sides of the House. But when he was selected by Al Gore as his running mate in 2000, within 24 hours he had abandoned most of the principles that he had espoused all his political life. He did a complete reversal to embrace the far-left positions of Al Gore. As soon as the election was over and the Gore-Lieberman ticket had lost, Lieberman went back to his position in the Senate, picked up his tattered principles, and began espousing them once more. But for a brief, shining moment, he became totally expedient, as politicians almost always are when their election or re-election is at stake. The first thing that happens to a politician when he decides to run for office is that he is confronted with the fact that politics is highly competitive, like an entrepreneurial marketplace. In most cases, there are lots of other capable, determined people who also want to serve in office. In too many cases, people running for office do not have much to run away from. They are usually trying to get away from lives and careers that are neither successful nor satisfying. They run for office seeking something outside of themselves to commit to and to believe in. They are looking for something that will give them a sense of meaning and purpose that their current lives do not. Since everyone is seeking meaning and purpose in life, there's nothing wrong with this. It's neither good or bad. It's just a fact of life. The only time this creates a problem is when people expect politicians to be other than they are. For many candidates, the income that they can receive in office is substantially more than they can earn in the private sector, and often more than they've ever earned before. For example, even the most mediocre legislator in this California state government earns more than $100,000 per year, plus all kinds of benefits and perks. Most of these people have never seen that kind of money in their entire lives. The pension plans for elected officials, usually kept as quiet as possible from the electorate, are extremely generous. Often they amount to hundreds of thousands of dollars and even millions in pensions over the course of a politician's lifetime. Sometimes a politician only has to serve one term and he then qualifies for thousands of dollars per month for life. One of the most important concerns of people in office is to pass laws and regulations that assure that they will be well provided for when they leave office. As Mark Twain once said, "We get the best government that money can buy." To get elected, and being expedient, politicians often abandon ideas they have espoused all their lives. Once they get into office, put there by the donations, support, and work of people who espouse certain ideas and want certain payoffs, the politician has to deliver. Once elected, the politician finds himself in league with other politicians of his party and often with members of the other party, all of whom who have promised rewards and favors to the people who elected them. It becomes immediately clear that there's not enough free money to go around. Compromises will have to be made. Some people will have to be paid off immediately and some later. To get anything done, to have any influence, a politician has to engage in the twin exercises of backscratching, which means working cooperatively with other politicians, and log rolling, which means supporting the promises of others in order to get support for his promises to his voters. In every case, alas, politicians get elected by offering some variation of something for nothing that will benefit their supporters. This is most common in the left wing, democratic socialistic parties, the members of which are mostly convinced that anyone who is successful deserves to have their money taxed away from them for the benefit of others. Sometimes politicians get elected by promising to defend individuals and groups against the something-for-nothing hordes that throng the state houses in Washington. Occasionally, they get elected by promising to cut off the free money going into some group, like the out-of-control workman's compensation scandal in California in 2004. Not only were costs three times the identical system of benefits offered by Arizona, with most of the money going to lawyers, chiropractors, doctors, and uninjured workers, but the amounts actually being received by genuinely injured workers were among the lowest in the nation. The only honorable reason to run for office is to work for legislation that rewards and encourages people to save, invest, and produce the wealth that our society depends on for growth and opportunity. It is to encourage entrepreneurship on the one hand, and to reduce the tax burden and weight of regulation on the other. The honest politician works to allow individuals to keep more of their hard-earned money and to reduce the number of people caught in the trap of government dependency. The good politician does everything possible to protect the private citizen or corporation against the free money crazies that get elected to power.
To continue, please insert the next CD.